Okay, well, thank you for all coming back. So I'm going to talk about the X-ray side and a little bit of the near-infrared from our last few years of campaigns of simultaneous multi-wavelength monitoring. But I'm going to leave details to Andreas Eckhardt's talk on the analysis of what we're learning from that. So as I'm sure a lot of you have seen, this is the 600,000 second image of the galactic center, the central 17 parsecs, about 40 parsecs on a side. By the end of this July, instead of 600,000 seconds, we'll finally have a megasecond. Since this image has been taken, we've gotten another 125 kilosecond, and we'll be doing 250 kiloseconds this summer. So here's the galactic plane, Sag A East, Sag A West, and Sag A Star are in here. And the feature that we believe is an outflow from Sag A Star is right there. Well, this orangish looking feature, let me go on to the next. So these red clumps that we see. So here's the galactic plane, there's the supernova remnant. And we see a series of cold clumps of gas perpendicular to the plane and passing through the central parsec.
How do you distinguish those cold clumps of gas and what are cold clumps of gas?
Yes, very good. I'm glad you asked that. I'm going to tell you. We don't have a lot of counts on these, but they're basically 1 to 2 keV gas. Okay, so Park et al., 2004, we produced equivalent line width maps of helium-like iron, so 6.7 kV, neutral iron, 6.4, sulfur and silicon at 2.5 and 1.8 kV. What you can see in the hot iron is that it's distributed right along the galactic plane. It has very little scale height perpendicular to the plane. So there's your hot gas. You see such a strong concentration here because of the very strong iron line inside Sag A East, the supernova. Now, if you look at neutral iron, you see there's a lot of diffuse emission up here, and that's what you were pointing out. Very high scale height, but not on the other side. And if you look in the region of the lobes that we're talking about, you don't get the strong iron line. So neutral means, yeah, 10, 15. So here what you're, here what you're looking at is X-ray fluorescence of molecular clouds. Then as you get to softer energies, of course, you still see this emission. So there's star formation activity, supernovas and things going on here. But you start to see the scale height beginning to grow as you go to the softer energies. And if you overplot, this is iron 6.4 kV, the image, and this is sulfur with CS contours here. You can see how well this emission up in the upper left that had the same apparent scale height as this emission, how it is very nicely associated with the molecular clouds. This is 17 arc minutes. That's 40 parsecs. So we believe the lobe material is distributed differently than the hot iron and the fluorescent or neutral iron. And again, the emission intensity grows as you go to the softer energies, it grows out of the plane. The temperature would be about 20 million degrees Kelvin, densities of around 1 per cubic centimeter. And if you assume a velocity of around 1,000 kilometers per second, the separate lumps would indicate possibly separate episodes of activity spaced by about 2,000 to 5,000 years. Of the clumps that we saw. These individual sort of clumps. And they don't have a lot of mass. We're only talking about one solar mass per blob. So we believe the fact that there seem to be multiple blobs with a time scale that's so short, only a few thousand years, argues more in favor of it being an outflow from Sag A star rather than stellar activity in the central parsec, which we would expect would take place on a much longer time scale. So now what I want to show you is, this is the Sag A region, of course, and here's a, so in 20 centimeters, in yellow I'm showing the 20 centimeter contours from Farhad Yousafzada's work. So you're seeing the non-thermal radio shell. And here's, Here, oh, the outflow or the outflow would be this way. On this intensity, you're not going to see very much of it. It would be over here on the intensity scale that I picked, suppresses it. So now I'm sort of moving on to looking at the inner Sag A region. The blue is the HCN, so this is showing you where the circumnuclear disk is, and this is a 6-centimeter VLA image. So this is 20 centimeters, but that's a 6-centimeter image, and you'll see that again in multiple images. We see a very strong, two very strong X-ray shocks that are right in the core of the supernova remnant. And as you can see, the X-ray emission of the supernova is filling the interior cavity, not along the edges. Apparently the gas has shocked, but it's so dense that it's cooled. And given the high column density of the galactic center, you don't see anything below about 1.5 keV. So you don't see X-ray emission from the shell, you see it from the interior where a shock must be propagating back in. And then here's the central parsec, so Sag A West is in here. Okay, so here are your mini spiral, eastern arm, northern arm, and the bar. And there again is the mini spiral, and I've tried to make this show up in green. Here's the northern arm, the eastern arm, and the bar. You can see how the intensity of the X-ray emission follows the contours of the CND. And one thing to note, though, is the northern arm and the bar don't cast a shadow. Now, the radio people have measured the kinematics, and they say that those features go on the backside of the supernova and come back. So what that argues is most of the X-ray plasma, which, of course, is probably from the colliding stellar winds and is in that central region, most of it is in front of these large radio structures, and therefore the structures don't cause any appreciable attenuation of the X-ray emission. Okay, looking again at, this is basically the central parsec. Here's 10 arc seconds, that would be 0.4 parsecs. Galactic plane is coming here again. We have a feature here that we believe is a pulsar wind nebula. It's about 0.3 parsecs long. We have 10,000 photons. It has absolutely no emission lines and a little bit of sign for synchrotron aging. So given the size of the feature, and it's got a head-tail morphology to it, it looks like there is in projection at least, there is a pulsar wind nebula within this radius here would be 10 arc seconds. That would be 0.4 parsecs. So that's a problem for high-energy telescopes that want to look for high-energy emission from the central parsec, because this, of course, could be a source of emission. Oh, so now I want to point out that we see this ridge, sort of a quarter circle. And I want to point out also that it's on the side that would point back towards the supernova remnant. This scale is a few parsecs. This would probably, so this is 0.4 parsecs, so this is about 3 parsecs here. And if you zoom in closer, you can see again this ridge of emission on this side. So one possibility is, all right, so one question is, why is there a ridge of emission on this side that is not duplicated on the other sides? Is it just a coincidence that it's in the direction towards the supernova remnant? So one suggestion that I've made is that the stellar cluster winds, which are about 10 to the minus 3 solar masses per year of material that are expanding out at an average velocity of 700 kilometers per second, may be impinging on the ejector of the supernova remnant. And if that's true, then we would know that, in fact, the central parsec is inside the supernova remnant. Now, that had been suggested, I think, by Pedler et al. In 1989 or so, in the radio, based upon the fact that we know the supernova is in bulk, at least, behind Sag A West, because you can see the free-free absorption of the non-thermal emission. But they do see some free-free emission, some non-thermal emission. So they propose that the central parsec is inside sort of the leading edge. And we think that this X-ray feature might be some evidence that that's the right idea. It can't be more than 10,000 years or so, or tidal shear would get rid of it. So it's of order 10,000. Now, this is really new, so hopefully I'll explain it. I just got this last night from my collaborators. Gabriel Rockefeller and Chris Fryer at Los Alamos have been trying to do smooth particle hydrodynamic simulations of this effect. So over here, what they're showing is, if I understood correctly, the green contours, the blue contours, or purple here, are they've set up, they've got the stellar winds going, and fine, everything's going along. And then over here, and this is when the supernova has just started. So this is in the plane of the sky from the point of view of an observer, where you would have the black hole and the supernova and the stellar cluster all in the plane of the sky, but it's not the same orientation, of course, as our images that I was just showing you. And here they've evolved to the point where the supernova ejecta would be impinging on the stellar winds. And what they're finding in the simulations is, in fact, as we had thought, the ram pressure of the stellar winds is great enough that the blast wave doesn't sweep it away, not when you get into the central half a parsec or so. The 10 to the minus 3 solar masses per year of material at 700 kilometers per second is just too strong, and it deflects. And so that could be the origin of the arc that we're seeing. Let me see. So the punchline here in the simulation is that the ejector from the supernova doesn't penetrate within the cloud of wind material ejected by the star. And I think this is mainly just to show you. So in their simulation, they've put in the circumnuclear disk as discrete blobs, which have enough mass that they're not going to be moved around by the supernova. And here's the winds of the stars, and the supernova would be over here. So basically, you've got the ejector going this way and blowing around the cluster wind. So that's very preliminary, but it does seem to be the best explanation for why we see this ridge. And it would imply that, in fact, the central parsec is inside that supernova ring. So now I'm going to start talking about the X-ray observations of Sag A star itself. And in October of 2000, we saw a nice factor of 45 flare. We had looked 1 year before, and in 1999 we'd seen, in about a 14-hour observation, we'd seen Sag A star in quiescence, but we didn't see any variability. Then, to our surprise, the next time we looked, we saw within an hour and a half a factor of 45 variation, with a factor of 5 drop in just 10 minutes, which gave us a handle on the size of the emitting region. The X-ray emitting region had to be within about 20 Schwarzschild radii, no larger than that. I didn't. This was our regular proposal for that year. We do look at objects more than once, if that's your question. So then we thought, well, so we wrote that up, and we thought we would look for more flares. And a lot of people told us, well, you've just seen an extraordinary event that doesn't happen again in your lifetime. So what we planned to do was 3 complete Chandra orbits to test that wisdom. Is that really true? And at the same time, we got ground-based infrared and radio observations. So here's the first half of a day of observations. Nothing's going on. The sun decided it would flare instead, and it shut down our spacecraft for a day. time that can't be returned, of course. Oh, sorry. And then we come back and we finish, after a day turned off, we finish the rest of the two-day orbit, and we see a factor of 5 flare that lasted about 1.7 hours. Now the sun has gone back into quiescence, everything's behaving itself. We get a nice 2-day orbit, and we get 3 more flares, factors of 5 and 6 and 5, time scales half an hour to an hour. The first flare was 3.5 hours, and that is still to date the longest flare we've seen. It's not the strongest one. XMM has seen a factor of 190 change in amplitude. Then in the third orbit, again, just 2 days, we get a factor of 25, a factor of 12, and a factor of 13, again on timescales of half an hour to 1.5 hour, although perhaps this is actually 2 flares. So from 10 hours into this observation to about 36 or so, in just over a day, Sagittarius Star flared extremely strongly 3 times. So the idea that, well, that was a once-off kind of event is wrong. So then we got some more time, didn't see anything. Okay, well, at this time, this is 2002, the infrared telescopes did not have adaptive optics yet. So first of all, you know, in those 2 days, there's only a certain period of time when your ground-based telescopes are actually able to look. And there was only one flare that corresponded with any of the infrared telescopes, and unfortunately they were switched to their spectrometer. So these aren't detections of a flare, these are just upper limits. What we did learn, though, was here's the ATCA at 3 millimeters. This is the SMA at 1 millimeter, but as you can see here, we're having some calibration effects here that they've been working on in the last few years. Anyway, here, you can see that the 3 millimeter flux doesn't do hardly anything. There's no evidence of a correlation with what the X-ray is doing in these 2 flares, which was a surprise to the theorists, but they quickly rebounded and they came up with an explanation. I will leave it to them to describe that. So if you take all of those, well, first if you exclude all of those flares and you want to look at just the quiescent emission, first of all, the quiescent emission is extended. It's about an arc second in size. That's 0.04 parsecs. That's about the Bondi radius for a 4 million solar mass black hole in that region. So there apparently is a standing shock right around the Bondi radius. This is the spectrum. Here I'm showing you an absorbed dust-gated power law plus a line. The line energy here is 6.6 keV. The 90% confidence level is 6.5 to 6.6. Does not go up to 6.7. Okay. Now, the next year, in 2003, with adaptive optics, the infrared people had already started to see Sagittarius Star flaring. Here is Sagittarius Star. Here it's brighter. Here it's faint. These are my VLT collaborators. And we had X-ray observations simultaneously. So here's the X-ray. Now, this event is so weak that you can't just by eye say, well, that's real. But we did a lot of statistical analysis. You can read about it in the paper to show that this is real. This Bayesian blocks algorithm developed by Jeff Scargill, not only, well, its advantage over a KS test, which we also ran. KS will tell you, did anything happen? But it won't tell you where it happened objectively. There is no parameter that allows us to decide where it is going to put the event, okay? And we found that at 99.9% confidence, this was a significant event, and the infrared was, the infrared telescope only started observing right around the peak. That just happened to be the observing window that they've been given, and here it is going down. So in 2004, we reported detecting the first simultaneous X-ray and infrared flare. The X-ray luminosity was about 6/10 to the 33 ergs per second, 3 times its quiescent rate. The near infrared was like 5/10 to the 34 ergs per second. While we could only say X-rays are coincident with 180 milliarc seconds, the near infrared people could say that it was coincident within 14 milliarc seconds. And so since the two are going together, we can bootstrap the X-ray position. Now last year, we repeated the experiment twice on two separate days. So on the first day, we don't get any significant X-ray flaring here. But on the second day, we were successful at seeing a factor of 18 flare. And here is the VLT coverage window. Now, we're interested in knowing, not only is this significant, is any of the rest of this significant? And the answer is probably not. So using the Bayesian blocks algorithm, at 99% confidence level, the only thing that is found is the main peak. If you drop it down to 90%, you pick up something over here, but if you make it 90.5, it's gone. So I would not say, based upon the X-ray, that that is significant. No? It's the same. Now, here's the X-ray in a more of a block histogram, and here's the infrared. And Andreas Eckhardt will talk about this in much more detail. So here's, of course, remember that time window was just at the very front. Here is the factor of 18 flare, and here is the infrared flaring nicely. But the most important or most surprising thing is, here's an infrared flare right where that little peak was that may or may not be true in the X-ray. It's almost as strong. It's not clear to us whether it's as long in duration, but it doesn't have a large amplitude X-ray flare. And also here and here, there's no obvious X-ray emission here and here. So in the model that we've developed, the infrared emission is direct synchrotron, and I'm sure you'll hear the infrared people talk about that. The X-ray emission would have to be synchrotron self-Compton, because if you extrapolate this direct synchrotron, it's orders of magnitude below the X-ray flares. So the fact that you don't always scatter the photons up into the X-ray band is probably to be expected. There must be a variety of flares. So this had a photon index of 1.3, but when something only lasts 1,000 seconds and you're only getting one count every 500 seconds or so, we only got about 120 counts here. So the uncertainty on the actual photon index is quite huge. I'll skip through this. I know that he'll talk about it. Taking all of our flares, here is the distribution of flare amplitudes. So of course we see more small amplitude flares, and we're starting to get distributions of flare durations, but it will take quite a few flares for that to be meaningful. I want to show you this animation. This is all of the Chandra data except last year's data. This is Sagittarius star flaring. These are transients, the four transients you heard Mike Muno talk about yesterday. There, a new one up here. I don't have the data that shows in this movie that shows the new flare, so I won't go into why, but we talked about that. Okay, just last few comments. Yep, that's it? Okay. Sorry.
We have time for just a few questions. Brad?
Have done any tests for the correlations from flare to flare? Because it looked to me like in windows where you actually had multiple flares, the amplitudes were similar. So there was one that was like 5, 6, 5, and this one's like 12, 13, 12. I mean, are the flares correlated?
Not that we can tell. They are not evenly spaced. We only had those two orbits where we saw multiple flares. Other than that, we haven't looked long enough to see a second flare. So it's, I don't think I really have the data for that.
Shep?
The X-ray and the infrared? The spectrum? The light curve? Yes. But that... No. But remember, I talked about there's an extended plasma inside the Bondi radius, or right at the Bondi radius. And that acts as a DC signal. You're not seeing down at the Schwarzschild radius the flaring going on in the X-ray because of this high background. The infrared people don't see that structure, and so they're always seeing the direct synchrotron. Yes. I certainly agree that other than the two that we've caught that are the same, we need to see this happen enough times where there's one that really correlates like this, that it's not an accident. But Andreas will show you what happens if you cross-correlate. Okay?
Okay. Yes. Mark?
So, I want to go a little longer. Okay. So if you look at this image, you see these shocks, and you see this feature here, which is about a light year long. It is unresolved. It's less than 0.04 parsecs wide, so it's got a greater than 10 to 1 aspect ratio. And WaveDetect finds this as which is a wavelet detection algorithm, finds this as a coherent structure with a position angle that goes within 1 degree of Sag A star, and the uncertainty on the position is greater than that. We've looked for it in the radio and the X-ray and the infrared, but we don't see it. However, I can tell you afterwards, that's probably dynamic range and the high signal to noise, the high background in the radio and the infrared. This is only 10 nanojanskis of X-ray emission. So it's quite consistent that you wouldn't see the related infrared or X-ray emission or radio emission in that region.
Okay, one more question, Paco?
No, the helium stars are for the most part inside that. That was 15 arc second radius, 15 to about 20 arc second radius. Most of the stars are inside that. IRIS 16 is in here.
IRIS 15.
Oh,
that's up north.
15.
You had another figure
where,
that showed the central
I don't
central
know where
region.
15 is okay. On this plot.
I was just saying that IRIS 15 does have an X-ray source associated with it. I'm not sure whether Paco's question was whether the winds from IRIS 15 could be dominating the outflow from that, or it's the dominant feature that's causing the pressure against Sag A East, and just because it's closest. And I'm not sure.
Thank you. I'd like to wrap this one up and have our next speaker, Delphine Porquet.